Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who is also the co-author of Heavy Lifting. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We are continuing with our year-end political awards, handing out those crystal martinis. This is the third installment. We have six installments in all. Today, our highly respected martinis go in the categories of worst scandal, best political theater, and worst political theater. So we begin with the worst scandal. And Jim, for me, it's the one that's been really dominating the presidential race for the almost the entirety of the year. And that's the Hillary Clinton email / server scandal. This was revealed back in February or March that she not only used a personal email account and failed to completely use a State Department email account, but she had her own private server that not only contained all of her work email, but also the fact that she was receiving classified information. She tried to say, well, it wasn't marked classified. She kept saying everybody did it. But no one's ever had all of their business going through a private account on a personal server, which did not have, obviously, the security apparatus in place that a State Department server would have. Now it's been revealed more recently that she had top secret email. Who knows who had access and was able to hack into that account and what information was compromised. She lied about it at the UN back in the spring. She tried to laugh it off by saying, wipe the server with a cloth and that sort of thing. She had this odd cackle when talking to Jake Tapper about it, as if she just laughed it off, that would somehow go away. And the only...
And the only... I have that box, you know, you open it up and it makes the laughing noise.
It's kind of like...
Anyway, didn't mean to interrupt. Carry on. Greg.
No. It reminds me kind of the in the old Jack Nicholson Batman movie. Where
yes, at the end of the movie.
And so the only help she's really gotten is from her chief rival for the Democratic presidential nomination, Bernie Sanders, who doesn't want to hear about emails. But nonetheless, the FBI is still investigating. We'll probably find out in the new year if they're ever going to do anything with it. But Hillary Clinton's negligence on the job, her risking national security for the sake of having this private server, and probably so there was no paper trail through FOIA requests that people could find out what she was doing. Just bad, 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 bad.
That is a fantastic selection there, Greg. We've had really good luck with these end-of-the-year martinis this year, because I generally think, all right, what is Greg going to pick? And then I think, all right, what else is there? And I came up with one. I'm happy. I think, you know, Hillary's email server is great, but actually maybe the most consequential scandal of this year, I would contend, is the hacking and compromised security at the Office of Personnel Management.
Absolutely.
Which is where 22 million current and former federal employees, and also apparently their families, had their personnel files hacked. The hackers stole the security dossiers, also got the fingerprints of 5.6 million federal employees. You can always get a new social security number. You can't get new fingerprints. And the great news, just a short while back, OPM announced, well, we finally sent out all the letters telling people their data had been compromised. So nice job, guys. The assumption of investigators is that China is building this huge database of information about American officials who enter China or do business with it. At one point, there was a report the CIA had to withdraw all of its personnel from China because the good news is they wouldn't have their stuff in the OPM files. The OPM, for obviously, you know, CIA seeming to sense something like this might happen someday, didn't keep their sensitive personnel files in the Office of Personnel Management's, you know, databases. However, that way you can go and cross-check the duty roster at an embassy and figure out who's really state and who's working for some other agency. You know, this was called America's Cyber 9/11, and I'd say, Greg, you know, it got attention, but I got about maybe a quarter of the media attention it deserved, you know, maybe a third at best. Archuleta, the director of OPM, eventually resigned, but another case where the president should have fired her. This is a you know, great irony, a political hack who's, you know, overseeing a terrible hack. She was completely unqualified. It was a enormous embarrassment. And the entire country and the Washington media largely averted their eyes from it because it just demonstrates the utter incompetence of government.
Now, it's certainly a great selection. I was very torn between the two, so I'm glad that we both covered the biggest scandals, and both of them kind of dealing with the same type of area with cybersecurity, and it appears that we're still behind the eight ball on that in a way that is very, very disturbing, and especially to folks whose files were compromised, which were obviously tens of millions. So on to best political theater, and Jim, one of the things we've enjoyed, and I use that term in quotations, over the past few months is the roughly monthly presidential debates for the Republicans. The Democrats always seem to hide theirs at the least watched time of days or weeks. But the Republicans have been very well watched. You can probably credit Trump to some extent for that, but also because there's probably a lot more interest on the right in changing things and how they're done in Washington. And the first couple of debates were pretty contentious. The Fox one, the CNN one at the Reagan Library. And then we got to the CNBC business debate, which was hosted by John Harwood and Carl Quintanilla and Becky Quick. And there were just a lot of questions about Trump. How are you really going to do this? Isn't this a comic book version of a campaign? And then there were Marco Rubio, your young man in a hurry. I'm getting ahead of my point here. But ultimately, the snarkiness of the questions kept building and building and building. And ultimately, it was Ted Cruz who not only had enough of it, but decided to take advantage of the moment as well. And here's how he did it.
The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
Sure, it was a bit of political grandstanding there by Ted Cruz, but CNBC absolutely deserved it for the way they handled the debate. And the results of that have been obvious, both at the Fox Business debate and at the more recent CNN debate on national security. The questions were far less snarky. They were far more substantive. And I think the voters, while maybe not popping as much popcorn to watch the interactions, learned a lot more about what these candidates believe and what kind of president they'd be.
I spoke too soon, Greg, because in this case, we did pick the same one. Something I would note, though, I think with the exception of that CNBC one, almost all of them have been good and solid. I think Fox News began with some serious fastballs that some folks may not have been expecting. I would put it to just about every listener out there, for all of our frustrations, there are too many people on stage, people might not be getting enough time, the kiddie table debate format was kind of insulting to everybody who participated, some deserving candidates, in my argument, Bobby Jindal didn't get the chance on the big primetime stage they deserved. For all the flaws, does anybody feel like they don't have a good sense of how these guys are as candidates and what they think? I think the debates have pretty much served that purpose. Even if you don't like one debate or another, I think everybody's gotten enough time collectively. I think everybody's gotten a pretty good time. I think they've had hard questions. I think they've had times to make their cases. They've had good moments and bad moments. Even in this, the most recent one, Donald Trump opened up with a more serious point than everybody expected. I think one of the reasons that Ben Carson enjoyed his fall surge was he had a really good closing answer in the debate where he talked about, as a brain surgeon, he's operating on what makes a person who he is, not the color of his skin. I think there was Carly Fiorina, and that kiddie table debate surged ahead. Most of the candidates have done a pretty good job with this, showcased what they're really good at. In the case of John Kasich, he's really good at karate chops. Some candidates didn't do quite as well, Jeb Bush. And in a way, some people might argue whether the debates are overemphasized or we overhype them. And within a week or two, nobody remembers them. Look, this is part of being a candidate. And it's can you be up on stage? Can you think on your feet? The sound clip you played, I think, was probably Ted Cruz's best moment of the year. And I think, look, for all of our frustrations with the RNC and all that, I think this has handled out pretty well. I don't think we needed the 20 we had last cycle. We've had 5 so far, right?
Yes.
And it's been pretty good. Maybe you want to have one or two more in there. But, I feel like we're getting to know these candidates pretty well. And I salute all of the networks except CNBC. And hopefully there'll be more of them in the year to come.
Well, there certainly will be. Several more before the first ones. And I believe National Review is even part of one of them. So
that's the plan.
Looking forward to that. Okay, on to worst political theater of the year now, Jim. And for that, I take everyone back to late June of 2015. That is, of course, Supreme Court decision time for some of the most controversial cases. And as you all know, with Anthony Kennedy, a majority opinion, the court ruled 5-4 that, in fact, the Constitution somehow does give a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. President Obama went to the Rose Garden to bask in that decision, and in the midst of being very happy about the decision, he said this.
I know that Americans of goodwill continue to hold a wide range of views on this issue. Opposition in some cases has been based on sincere and deeply held beliefs. All of us who welcome today's news should be mindful of that fact, recognize different viewpoints, revere our deep commitment to religious freedom.
So be respectful in victory. So what did the White House do that night as soon as the sun went down? Lit up the White House in rainbow lights. So Jim, I don't think the White House probably ought to be lit up under any circumstances, but it didn't happen when they killed bin Laden. It doesn't happen on the 4th of July or Memorial Day or Veterans Day or anything that might warrant a red, white, and blue lighting up. The president there talking about how we need to be humble in victory just rubs it ridiculously in the face of traditional marriage supporters. And that gets my award for worst political theater of the year.
That's a really good choice, Greg. And I was thinking about that. Like, at what point did the White House turn into the Empire State Building?
Right.
I mean, you know, we turned it, you know, pink for Breast Cancer Month and all that. And you know, all of a sudden, the Empire State Building is turning different colors every single night to honor this cause or that cause or this team won or something, you know. Someday it'll be green and white. But anyway, the point being, like, you know, all of a sudden the White House has turned into that, and it just doesn't feel like, no, that's not what the White House is there for. It's supposed to be this unifying symbol for all of us. I went in a different direction for my nominee for the worst political theater of the year. Kind of the flip side of my my good theater. The Democrats are not having good debates. And I say this, look, we are men of the right. We don't really care that much who the Democrats nominate. We're gonna dislike all of them unless they, you know, went cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and decided to nominate Jim Webb or something like that. But if I'm a Democrat, first of all, I'd like to have a real choice in my, you know, in my presidential primary. I don't want to have a coronation of Queen Hillary. I want to see what my options are. And the, you know, under the management of Debbie Wasserman Schultz at the DNC, they chose to have four debates before Iowa, two of them on Saturday night, because, you know, nobody's got anything they're doing on weekends or something. I mean, maybe that's a symbolism, right? The Democrats are the party of people staying at home and not doing anything. They have no friends. But, you know, like, so you've for a while there, they thought Biden might jump in there. Bernie Sanders is one of the big stories of the year, kind of pushing against Hillary. You know, Martin O'Malley hasn't really gone anywhere. Shocking the slogan, "I'll do for America what I did for Baltimore," isn't catching fire, so to speak. But, you know, if you believe in democracy, you know, these people deserve a chance on the stage to go make their case. Now, you pointed out that Sanders basically surrendered on the email issue earlier. But ultimately, like, they, you know, Democrats deserve a real debate. In this case, actually, I don't think the questioning has been that bad. But I do think that the lack of them. I think the group think, the eagerness to each one to prove that they're more liberal and opposed to Republicans than the other is kind of ridiculous. They interject Donald Trump into every answer they can. It's been very frustrating. And I think the sheer lack of them, it certainly looks like that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was trying to grease the skids for Hillary Clinton. O'Malley's made this point a few times. And to quote Bob Odenkirk, Greg, this is a travesty. It is a sham. And it is a mockery. It is a Travisher mockery, the best way to describe the Democratic debate system of 2015-2016.
Oh, absolutely. And if you've actually bothered to watch Hillary Clinton's performance, you know exactly why. And it's just a shame that Link Chafee didn't stick around longer, because if the Americans had just heard a little bit more about the need to convert to the metric system, I think there would have been a groundswell there.
Yep. Meanwhile, Jim Webb is still waiting to be called on.
Jim, on that note, have a great day. We'll have more prestigious awards to give away tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.